How you doing? We're back with episode 404 on the Flip Empire Show.
Welcome to the Flip Empire Show, bringing you the interviews, strategies, and insights for smart real estate investors. Prepare to dive into the minds of real estate's heavy hitters and gain the cutting-edge expertise you need to scale and grow your real estate empire. Your success and freedom starts now with your host, Alex Pardo.
Before we dive into today's masterclass expert interview, I want to let you know that this show is sponsored by Ascend, our in-house assembly of success-minded people, business owners, and entrepreneurs actively collaborating together to ascend our businesses to new heights while also experiencing truly happier, more fulfilling lives at the same time. We believe it's not an either-or, but you can truly have both and. It's the unique and rare combination of mastermind coaching and community that makes Ascend so special. But it's definitely not for everyone. If you're an entrepreneur who's looking for more than your typical mastermind or coaching, and you think these things can help you accelerate your ascension from where you are today to where you want to go while living a more meaningful and rewarding life in the process, then you can head over to ascendyoursuccess.com, click the application button, and we'll go from there. What's going on, guys? I have an awesome podcast with an incredible guest, a friend of mine, somebody who, as you're about to hear, I've learned a lot from throughout the years, none other than Mr. Rob Swanson. This is actually Rob's third time back on the show. I had him for episode 14, episode 92, and here we are a couple of years later on episode 404. My friends, this could, and I don't say this with hyperbole, this could easily be one of the most important podcast episodes that you listen to. And I say that because, you know, Rob has been through a market cycle already. He's been in this business for a couple of decades, and he is just always out in front of these things. Obviously, none of us have a crystal ball. None of us know exactly, you know, what's going to happen with the, you know, the real estate market. Are we in a recession already? Is there a housing crash coming? Is it imminent? You know, what's going to happen with the presidential elections at the end of this year, if you're listening to this in 2020? But I just want to kind of highlight just a few of the things. This is about an hour of pure content where, you know, Rob shares some perspective and kind of, we don't spend a ton of time talking about his background and how we got into this business, but, you know, Rob started to sell off his assets in 2006, a couple of years before essentially the market crashed. And he did that because he was tracking inventory levels. He was tracking price movements. And he shares with you exactly how you can do that in today's market. He talks about his $30 million mistake. Again, $30 million mistake. We talk about boom and bust markets and price stable markets. What defines each of those? When you should be entering into one versus exiting out of the other, depending on where we are in the market cycle. The one important question that any real estate investor, whether you're getting started in this business or whether you're a seasoned pro who's done hundreds, if not thousands of deals, what's the one question you always need to ask yourself? We talk about generating more leads, making offers, and why that's so critical, even more now than in any other point, right? The three types of capital, you know, and how it relates to where you're at in the business. We talk about one of the things that I just come out and hit Rob with is, hey, brother, what's your advice? Give me practical advice for three different people. Number one, give me the practical advice if you're talking to somebody who is just getting started in this business. And by the way, as it relates to the current economic climate where we're at today. Number two, for the intermediate investor, somebody who's done deals, but maybe they're experiencing a little bit of an income roller coaster. You know, they have good months, they have bad months. What's your practical advice for that person? What would you share with them based on your knowledge and experience? And number three, the seasoned, experienced investor, someone who has positioned themselves in their business, someone who's prepared for a housing crash, you know, somebody who has capital, what's your advice for them? And so we talk about all of that. You know, again, there's so much that we talk about. This could easily be one of the most important episodes you listen to. And so without further ado, I just, you know, I'm excited to jump right into it and have this conversation with Rob Swanson.
Rob Swanson, third time on the show, my brother. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing awesome, man. Thank you very much for having me back, Alex.
Yeah, man. It is always, it's always a pleasure connecting with you, brother. I've learned so much from you throughout the years. And I'm excited to get into this. You and I were just talking before we hit the record here. It's interesting times we're in. And I kind of want to just let people know at the time that we're recording this, it's Monday, March 23rd. So you're probably listening to this, weeks, if not months later. And obviously a lot probably has changed, Rob, since the time that we're recording this. But you and I were just talking. I don't think it's going to matter. I think some of the questions I want to ask you and get your perspective and feedback on, I think are pretty much going to, you know, be timely no matter when they're listening to this.
That's right.
Part of the reason I wanted to have you on, so you don't know this, brother, but when this whole thing happened week and a half, 2 weeks ago, you were one of the first people that I thought I'd love to get you back on the show to get your thoughts, not just because of your experience, but because, you know, you positioned yourself well, you know, before the last crash. You started selling off, I believe, your assets in 2006. You positioned yourself, and then you've talked about the $30 million mistake, you know, 2008, 2009. So I kind of want to pick up there just to give people some context. So a little bit about, you know, where you were at in business at that point, how you positioned yourself during the last crash. And then where I'd love to take the conversation, Rob, is for people listening to this, you know, people are going to be in different situations. There's going to be new people that are just getting into this business. There's going to be experienced investors that maybe aren't well positioned for this. And then there's going to be those that have been, positioning themselves to prosper moving forward. So I'd love just to have a conversation about your thoughts on how people can, where they go from here based on the uncertainty of the economic climate and where the real estate market may or may not go.
Yep. Awesome. Right. Looks great.
Beautiful, man. Beautiful. So jump in, brother. Why don't we pick this up? I know you got started in real estate early 2000s. Is that right?
Yeah, I jumped in 1998, and I did it. I did it wrong for 3 years. I started doing it right in about 2000, 2001, and that's when things kind of took off for me. I invested in my education. I figured out some of the tools and missing pieces that I didn't have, and here we are today, 20 years later.
Beautiful, beautiful. So, what was it about during that time? Because I heard you talk last week about how in 2006. You kind of started to see the writing on the wall as far as like what was probably going to happen to the real estate market, and you had the stock market, just so much going on around 2008. And this is this is different. It's not like we're dealing with fraud and we're dealing with all the kind of stuff we were dealing with back then, but there's still a lot of turmoil in the stock market and there's a lot of uncertainty with the housing market. What was it that you saw back then that kind of got you out in front of the curve? Because I think that'd be a valuable lesson for people is what do they need to start looking at when it comes to like, you know, real estate cycles, I believe, go in about 18 years or so. So I'd love for you to kind of share with people what you saw back then. And then more importantly, how people can start to read some of the tea leaves moving forward so that they can position their business entering into certain markets. I know you talk about boom bust markets, price stable markets, which we'll get into later.
Yep. Yeah. So for me, it was this. I got into the real estate market in the late 90s, early 2000s, started to do it right. Without going back into the whole story again, people can watch, you know, other videos I've put out that kind of share my story. But I started tracking markets in 2004. And I had the opportunity to get exposed to different markets around the country. Back in the early 2000s, before virtual wholesaling was a virtual wholesaling thing, before our friend Chris Chico came out and coined it, I was traveling around the country and then coming back to Denver, running my business and then traveling around the country and teaching real estate investors how to launch their business in their local market. And I started to say, wait a minute, I like to live in Denver. I want to live here. This is where I want to be, but I want to invest in other places. And so before all of the tools that we have today, I was investing virtually across the country. And so I started to track markets as a result of that. And what we were doing, Alex, is we were tracking the supply and demand. So we were tracking inventory levels and we were tracking price movement of over 8,000 cities and 43,000 zip codes across the country. I built little software back in the day that was going out and kind of scraping and pulling in this data on a weekly basis. And so in 2006, to answer your question, what did I see? What I saw is supply was beginning to go down. Actually, here's what I saw first. I saw prices begin to flatten. Okay. So we had seen prices going up as supply was constricted, right? And so as we're tracking markets across the country, prices are going up, supply is low. And we did everything on a per capita basis. So we were comparing apples to apples inside of our data sets. And that sounds really nerdy. It basically means we were tracking one city to another, and we were able to compare those two cities, right? And so what we did is I started to see prices flatten out. So instead of going up and up and up and up and up, I started to see prices flatten out. And what happened shortly after that is, and this was, there was a lag of 4 to 6, maybe 6 to 8 months, mm-hmm. where all of a sudden then inventory levels started to climb. So supply started to go up. And so in addition to the media talking about bubble and froth and all this stuff that was happening back in 2006, and the stock market, some tumultuous times in early 2007, and some of those conversations, I said, you know what? I see it in the data. I'm mm-hmm. hearing it in the media. I think I'm going to sell most of my portfolio today. And so I started to sell most of my portfolio, take those chips off the table. And then in 2007, when it really kind of started to fall apart in August, I was pretty well positioned, and I was able to say, okay, what do I do going forward? And at that moment, I said, I want to put a bunch of capital together. I want to put a big fund together, and I want to start buying in the turmoil, in the crash. To go back to Warren Buffett's phrase, you know, be greedy or be fearful when everybody's greedy and greedy when everybody's fearful. I started to ask myself in August 2007, what does that phrase really mean? And what it meant to me was, all of a sudden, everybody went from real estate can do no wrong to, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. the world is ending. Fear entered the real estate market. Everybody exited. And I said, it's time to go all in.
Got it. So let me take a step back, and there's a lot to unpack there. For somebody listening to this that's like, all right, how do I go about, you know, that doesn't have access to this type of software, how do I go about just on a basic level tracking inventory levels, tracking the price levels? Like, any practical feedback on how people can access this data to start to actually read and understand what's going on in the market, and specifically in their market today?
Yeah, you can go to Zillow.com, and I think it's if you go to /research, I think it's housing-data. I can't remember the exact URL, but if you go to Zillow and look for Zillow's housing market data, uh-huh. you can go see. Now Zillow's data only goes back to around 2011. So this is like 3 years post the last crash. But you can see a lot of this data now publicly available via Zillow. Now, they don't aggregate it and automate some of the analysis like what we were doing. But you can go market by market, go into your market and go look and ask yourself what's been going on over the last, decade, mm-hmm. and look at price movement, look at rent movement. You know, are rents going up or down, and prices going up or down? And obviously, for the last decade, pretty much every city in the country is going to be a 30% mm-hmm. slope upwards.
Yeah, got it. And are you tracking that on a week-to-week basis, month-to-month basis?
Well, when we automated, you know, the tracking, we did it on a week to week basis. Okay. I don't think people need to do that. It becomes cumbersome, and you're not going to make decisions based on that in a local market. So yeah. I don't think they need to.
Understood. So I probably piqued somebody's interest when I said $30 million mistake, which you've talked about in the past.
Yeah.
Brief recap, what exactly do you mean by $30 million mistake? Because that's a pretty big mistake, right?
Yeah, it's a big mistake. So in 2008, the first quarter, we funded our first round, the second quarter of 2008, I put a $10 million fund together. Prior to that, I did a lot, you know, millions of dollars just in individual private money notes. Mm-hmm. I said, I want to go all in. I want to control the capital fund. And so I went out and I raised $10 million from they were $175 million fund at the time out of Stamford, Connecticut. They are about $1 billion fund today. And in 2008, I put a $10 million tranche together with them, and I started buying real estate. And I was buying, fixing, and flipping. And my $10 million mistake is I should have taken every dime of the $10 million, and I should have bought as much real estate as I could on day one. Mm-hmm. And just disconnected the utilities, boarded them up, and rehabbed them and rented them out as I got to them. If I would have done that, and what I did instead is I bought, fixed, and sold. Bought, fixed, and sold. And so we were constantly redeploying the capital. We were moving the money. We were turning the money over and over again. And our constraint was always construction, right? And so it took us a while to draw down up to the $10 million. In fact, we never drew down every dime because by the time we would go sell millions of dollars worth of assets, we had that money available again and we would redeploy it. And so what I should have done is just bought $10 million worth of real estate day one and just sat on it and waited because the market had already made its initial adjustment and should have done that.
Now, where were you buying, Rob? What market were you in?
We were in Denver. Okay. So I had been investing in other markets prior to 2007 in what I would call more price stable markets. And then we came back to in 2007 and 8 when the crash and the adjustment, the first adjustment happened. I brought that capital back to Denver because Denver is a boom and bust market. And so in the downside, in the bottom of a crash, you want to be buying in boom bust markets to ride it back up. Right. When you're towards the top, you want to be buying in price stable markets so that you don't lose significantly.
So that's a perfect transition. That's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is boom bust markets, price stable markets. What defines each? I'm assuming your boom bust markets are your coastal markets, you know, like the Miamis of the world, the Californias, Phoenix, Denver. Price stable market, I'm assuming, is more middle America. How do you define, for people listening, price stable and a boom bust market?
Yeah, you can look just historically. And, you know, over the last 30, 40 years, there's published data by the federal government that shows price appreciation and adjustments. You can find these graphs city by city by city by city or metropolitan area by metropolitan area. And kind of how I define boom bust markets is any market that increases in drops greater than 20%, or a lot of times I'll look at about a 30% number, greater and up and down 30% in those crash moments. A price stable market combines the combination of it doesn't go 30%. It probably is around that 15 or 20% maximum crash. So it's pretty price stable. But more importantly, in a price stable market, I'm looking for the income levels on rental. So I like to see price to income ratios where I can go in and buy a median and still be net positive cash flow. Okay. Even if I buy at the median price, I can be net positive cash flow. Okay. That's what I call a price stable market.
Understood. So that would be like your Cleveland, Ohio's, you know, the Ohio markets, Memphis, Tennessee, markets like that, right?
Yep.
Okay. That's right. Perfect. So why don't we start to draw some parallels here? Let's kind of hit the fast forward button. Like I said at the beginning of the show, March 23rd, when we're recording this, what are you seeing is going on right now with the coronavirus as far as how it's impacting real estate investors? What are some of the questions we need to be asking ourselves? And then we'll start to have a conversation about how do we position and prosper moving forward based on what's going on and some of the uncertainty that, quite frankly, you and I just don't have the answers to at this point.
Yeah. I don't have a crystal ball. So, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't speak to exactly what it's going to do going forward. But what I can tell you is that how it's affecting people right now is people are living in fear because either they haven't been through something like this before, meaning a market correction, right? Not coronavirus, but a market correction. And so a lot of the fear is the, I don't know what's going to happen with the market. And then there's fear that's, I don't know what's going to happen with the coronavirus. But let's back this whole train up for a second. And let's say that it doesn't matter what the root cause of the fear or the turmoil is. Let's just assume for a moment that it doesn't matter what the root cause is, but that there are symptoms that occur inside of a market, meaning at a household level, people make less and things cost more and they don't have the dollars and cents to afford rent and to afford their mortgage payments, right? At a very fundamental level, take out the fear, take out everything else, the root cause. At a fundamental level, people can't afford to live. And that, and whether that's because liquidity gets taken out of the market, right? Bankers make and bankers crash markets. Whether that's because people lose their jobs, whether that's because, as it happened in 2007 and 8, adjustable rate mortgages adjusted, right? And so the root, and today, you know, in 2008, it wasn't that people lost their jobs at first. It was that adjustable rate mortgages adjusted, whether those were business loans, personal mortgages, whatever, they adjusted. And all of a sudden people were upside down inside of their household budgets. Right. Well, today with coronavirus, people are, I mean, mandated shutdowns. People are losing their jobs. People are don't have the income, and therefore the expenses are greater at the household level. The cause is different. The result is the same. People can't afford stuff, and that then triggers tenants not paying. That triggers evictions. That triggers mortgage foreclosures. That triggers all sorts of things into the market.
Yeah.
And so as a real estate investor, you look at that and say, well, what happens as a result of this? And you know, this isn't a vulture conversation. This is a, how do we help people, right? Exactly. Because regardless of which side of the coin you sit on, wealth transfers hands at certain points in history. And you just have to decide, are you going to be on the giving side of the wealth or on the receiving side of the wealth? And so as a real estate investor, I choose to be on the receiving side of that wealth transfer and do that in such a way that I help people through a really bad time. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of what I see, whether it's coronavirus or anything else. At a household level, people's expenses go up, their incomes go down, they can't afford it. That triggers something in the housing market, and we get to now participate in helping solve it.
Yeah, yeah. So why don't we start here? Let's start for, you know, somebody who is maybe not that experienced, has been thinking about jumping into this business, or is already in this business. They've been educating themselves. Maybe they haven't done a deal. Maybe they've done a few deals, but they just don't have the experience. They haven't been through a cycle before. Yep. No better time, you and I both know, than to jump in, regardless of when that is, right? As long as you educate yourself and take the right type of action. What's your advice for that person? You know, and understanding that there's a lot of variables at play, like what market are they in? What's their niche? What's their model? Generally speaking, what's the type of advice you have for somebody who, you know, let's just assume they don't have a whole lot of capital, but they have a strong desire to succeed in this business and they want to help people and they want to make money?
Yeah. Well, so let me just ask this question. That person, are they willing to do the work or not?
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. That's the fundamental question, because people always say they want the result. They're never willing to do the work. I'm at my house. I'm in my home office. You could walk out the doors right here and go find my wife and ask her, hey, to get where he is today, did Rob have to work hard? Like, did your family sometimes forego some of the immediate benefits for the long-term benefits? Mm-hmm. When we were early married and little kids, did we have friends that went corporate America route and took fancy vacations, and we went entrepreneur route and we said, we can't do it because we're building something here? Mm-hmm. So the question is somebody willing to do the work? And if the answer is they're willing to do the work, then there's no better time to get into real estate or any business for that matter than right now. Yeah. And because anytime there is an uncertainty transition, it creates holes of opportunity inside every business, because a lot of people that were filling holes in the past are no longer there. And that hole still exists and it needs to be filled. So I like this as a business model strategy, if you will. That person that gets into real estate, get in and learn. right? Number one, get in and learn. Learn the answer to this one question. If you can answer this question, you can become successful as a real estate investor. How do I make money with this deal? Mm. If you can answer that question, you can be successful. So now I don't care if you're looking at an apartment complex, a single family house, a condo, a vacation rental, a commercial building, you name it.
Yeah.
Right? If you can look at it and answer, how do I make money with this deal? You now have the ability to make money as a real estate investor and fill that gap, because you can now choose to either be the investor that participates in making money on that deal the way you now know how to do it, mm-hmm. or you get to be the guy that was the deal finder and you go sell that deal to another investor and you educate them on how to make money. But where I think wholesalers make their mistake is they get this idea that I'm just going to make an offer, get a property under contract, and somebody that knows what to do with it is going to come along. In this market, I believe you have to become an authority. So you need to learn, get knowledge. You need to be able to answer that question, how do I make money with this deal? Okay. Because that's what's going to give you the tools.
Yeah, understood. And that makes 100% sense. And so are you... You know, I've always said wholesaling, I think, is you know, the easiest and quickest way for people to, you know, make a dollar in this business. And I think it's kind of almost like the foundation. Yep. Talk to me about the importance, and we don't have to spend a ton of time on this, but I see so many newbies or people that have a desire to succeed in this business. They're chasing too many rabbits and they're catching none. Talk to me about the importance of picking a niche, jumping in, and just focusing on that. You know, you think about the one thing, the pumpkin plan. There's so many of these books out there
right.
that talk about that. But yeah, yep. people follow that advice.
Right. Yeah. I mean, focus, man, is the deal. You've gotta jump in and you've gotta focus and become a master of something. Mm-hmm. And so what I did, like I remember the day where I swung my feet to the side of the bed in my early real estate investing career. My feet hit the floor and I knew what to do. Mm-hmm. Like I knew what to do to make money. And there was that transition point. It was a Monday morning, like had the weekend, hung out. I had little kids at the time. My kids are now grown, but I had little kids. My feet hit the floor and I'm going to go make it as a real estate investor. And I remember that moment thinking, I know exactly what I need to do today. I need to go generate leads and I need to make offers. I need to generate leads and I need to make offers, because I had educated myself mm-hmm. on how was I going to make money with this deal. I knew the answer to that question, or I knew that I could figure out the answer to that question. And so generate leads, make offers, you know, price cures everything, Alex. Yeah. And so as fear enters the market at any time from no matter what source and values and prices go down, make your offer a little bit cheaper. Mm-hmm. Like the one constant is change and price cures everything. So just make a cheaper offer today than you made last month.
Yeah.
And just go with the market.
Yeah. And I think you bring up a really good point, Rob. I think it's extremely critical that people understand their market, you know, study what's going on with price points, and adjust your buy box accordingly, right?
Yep, because the
offer that you were making last month is probably not the same offer you're making now. And just, it's so important to follow up. I mean, that's a whole separate conversation, but people's motivations are changing or will be changing. So you got to stay in front of them.
Let's
move on now to somebody who has what I would consider maybe the intermediate. Let's say they're doing a couple of deals a month or whatever the case might be. And the number isn't really relevant, but they've done deals. They're doing deals.
Yep. Yep.
Maybe they're riding a bit of the income roller coaster that I think most wholesalers and real estate investors experience from time to time. Let's say they have a little bit of capital. They have some cash put aside, but they don't have much of a runway, maybe a month to 3 months, you know, and it's a machine. They got to keep, you know, doing deals and generating cash. Why don't we kind of cater the conversation to that person? If somebody were to come to you and says, hey man, I have knowledge, I have experience, I know what I'm doing, but my business kind of does this.
Yep.
You know, and I'm in this market now. What's the conversation we're having?
Yep. position yourself as an authority. If you know how to make money as a real estate investor. So this is where like the Instagram posts are cool and catchy and people like them, right? But people don't think deep enough about them to say, what does it mean? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about an Instagram post that we make or made recently, and I think I posted it on my Facebook too, and it was three types of capital, right? Knowledge capital, relationship capital, and financial capital. And so that guy that and gal that knows how to make money, knows what to do, but is saying, how do I navigate forward? You've got the knowledge capital. Start to build the authority around the relationship capital. And okay. The reason you do that is because you want people to see you as a solid anchor in times of turmoil, right? I'll be honest with you. That's what we're doing right now, right? I'm coming on here saying, look, I've got some experience navigating this. I don't have a crystal ball to go forward, but I know that no matter what is thrown at me going forward, I'm going to figure out how to navigate it, right? There may be blind spots ahead, but I'm going to use history and connecting some dots to try to lighten up some of those blind spots and dark alleys before I get there in order to put some things into play. And so that person, focus in on the relationship capital side of it, become an authority, get involved in your local real estate groups and associations, start a little Saturday breakfast club where you're talking about investing in real estate and you're sharing your thoughts and your stuff. Become the central hub where people and community can kind of come together and talk through these things. Yep. That's what takes you from that guy and gal doing a few deals here, trying to figure out how to navigate it, and then moving to that next level where now you are really, making it happen.
I so love it, and I can relate on so many levels, you know. And the truth of the matter is, Rob, we have no excuses now. You can start and launch a podcast. You can, in a couple of minutes, start a Facebook group, a local Facebook group for other investors in your market. You can start a meetup group, you know, and if you can't meet up with people now because of the quarantine or whatever, you can do it on Zoom like we're doing. I mean, there's so many resources, brother. You just gotta, I think it goes back to what you were saying. How bad do you want it? And are you willing to put in the work, right?
That's right. That's it.
So now let's kind of take it a step further. Let's say somebody who, you know, has your knowledge, has your experience or similar, and they've been ready for this moment. And maybe they've been sitting on a bunch of cash and stacking some cash. Maybe they have some assets. They have some cash flow coming in. What's the conversation for that person? And I want to kind of lead with how we can help others, understanding that they operate and run a business. And obviously, there's going to be financial gain and there's going to be, they need to be compensated. But what does that person do moving forward to continue to grow and scale their business, generate more cash flow while at the same time helping others? And maybe even connecting with the newer / intermediate investors that just haven't gotten to that level.
Yeah. Well, it goes to the third capital, which is the financial capital, right? If you've already got the knowledge capital. So the first guy, Gail, we talked about has to focus on the knowledge capital. They got to answer that one question. How do I make deal? How do I make money with this deal? The second is that intermediate. They got to focus on the relationship capital, because guess what? Inside of the relationship capital, you're going to get all the money and all the deal flow and all the knowledge and all the opportunities that you need to go to the next level. The person that's already got those two things and is at that next level, they got to start to focus on the financial capital. They've got to go get access to more capital, bigger dollars that they can deploy when the timing is right. Mm-hmm. This is why a couple years ago, Alex, I franchised our business, was because I knew that this was coming. And I have me recorded, you know, so many times talking about, guys, here's why we're franchising the business. Because when the market adjusts and crashes and it's going to again, I want to have all of the systems vetted. I want to have the market's vetted. I want to have operational efficiencies across markets so that I can go work with larger sources of capital and be able to effectively and efficiently and intelligently deploy that capital. So the guy, gal that's at that level, ask yourself, what systems, processes, procedures do you have in place? What authority are you using to gain exposure out there in the world? Yep. And when the big capital partner is connected, gets connected to you and you do something about it, how are you going to deploy that money? And so the guy and gal that's experienced and is navigating now the next thing, I think it's larger capital, bigger amounts of money that can be deployed because you already know the answer to the question, how do I make money?
That's right. Okay, got it. And what are they doing with that capital? Are they partnering with people? Are they acquiring assets in price stable markets? There's any number of things obviously they can do with the capital, but we'd kind of love to hear some of your thoughts. You know, you're in that position right now.
Yeah.
What are some of the things you're thinking through, if you don't mind sharing?
Yeah, well, every one of the, and this is what my $30 million mistake that we just talked about, right? I went through the last crash and I went through it successfully. And every one of the old school chain smoking, hard money, 85-year-old private lenders or hard money lenders here in town, like they're telling me, Rob, here's what you do. You know, take all the capital, buy everything you can get your hands on, disconnect utilities, board them up, and wait. Now, wait means rehab them as you get to them, rent them out as you go, but buy everything you can get your hands on. Yeah. Now, that's when the market makes that correction, right? And so a lot of what I talk about and teach is, what do you do before, during, and then after that crash? And there's that during phase where there's the uncertainty, right? It's before the market has made its big correction. It's before we're at the bottom and before people are like, okay, we know how we navigated down to the bottom. We're not sure how we're going to navigate back up, but the fear, the panic is gone. The reality has set down. The wealth has been transferred. The adjustments have been made. And now we're at a new bottom and we're going to ride it back up. We're not there yet, right? I don't see that we're there yet. We're still in this. We're not sure. And so one of the things I talk a lot about is, I call it the rubber band theory. And in 2007, when I started to put the fund together, and in 2008, when we started to buy aggressively, people were telling me that I was crazy. I was too early. And everybody was telling me I was too early, except the 85-year-old guys that were telling me, here's what you should do. And I didn't listen. Everybody else, oh man, they'd been through it. They're like, look, Rob, here's what happened in 73, 74. Here's what happened in 90, 91, the RTC days, the savings and loan. Here's what's going to happen right now. And I didn't listen to them. And so I didn't buy and hold everything I could get my hands on. And that's what I should have done. So the rubber band theory is this. People were telling me, you don't know how far down it's going to go. And I had the theory that I had an idea, because I was buying, you buy for one of two things. You buy for either short-term quick flip gains, uh-huh, or you buy for long-term cash flow gains, right? That's real estate investing in a nutshell. It's either short-term or long-term. And so I started to look at real estate through the lens of a long-term eye. And I did that because after each of the last three housing market crashes, rents on single-family homes went up.
Okay.
Simple supply and demand. Now, I started to look at that reality, and I started to look at it. Can I predict how low the market has to go in order to decide whether buying today is the right time? And so the rubber band theory says this: if I can buy a house that rents, say, for $1,000 a month, and my analysis says I'm good if I have a net cash flow after all expenses of $250 a month, right? $250 a door, that's my buy box from a cash flow standpoint. Okay. Well, when the market's going down, that $250 a month price point, all of a sudden I can buy it cheaper and I can get $300, and then I can get $400, and then I can get $500, and then I can get $600 a door cash flow. That's the rubber band stretching down. At some point, somebody says, well, gosh, Rob, or gosh, market, I don't need $600 a door. I'm happy with $500. So they bid the price back up a little bit. And then that goes now. That's our new normal. And then another investor comes in and says, well, gosh, market, I don't need $500 a door. I'm happy with 400. And the price comes back up. So you can stretch this rubber band down to the bottom to say, what's the lowest that somebody can get? What's the most cash flow they can stretch out of this thing before somebody else comes in and says, well, I don't need that much. That's your bottom.
Yeah.
You can now you just reverse your calculations and say, what's the price that yields that cash flow? That's the bottom price. And the bottoms are always driven by the investor. The bottoms are always driven by the investor. It's never driven by the retail market. The bottom of a market is an investor-driven position.
Right. Well, where do you think, and again, understanding that nobody knows, nobody's holding you to this, but just based on you having been through, you know, a cycle already, having studied the data, where do you think, and I'm not really asking for a prediction, but just more of an opinion as to where you think we're at? Obviously, we got the upcoming election, and I think that, you know, you've talked a lot about how, you know, there's three things that have preceded all the previous crashes. You know, you've talked about a presidential election, stock market turmoil, and policy change, right? Financial policy.
Yep.
So those are the three things I've heard you talk about. We got an upcoming election at the end of this year. Where do you think we go from here as it relates to the housing market? What's your opinion based on what you've seen and what you're seeing?
Yeah. My theory is this, and this goes back to, we could talk a lot around why this theory exists. But bankers make markets and bankers crash markets. Mm-hmm. And then bankers,
right?
What's that? It's the liquidity. It's the availability of funds in the market.
Right.
And so what are we seeing right now? We're seeing the U.S. government and the Fed, which is not a federal entity for those that don't know, print money and pump dollars into the market. That's propping things up. My theory is that if Trump is elected again in November, we probably ride this out for another 4 years. And I think they're going to continue to do whatever they can to prop it, to keep it propped. We may start to see a lot of turmoil before the next president is elected in, you know, maybe back a year or so, but I think we go another presidential term cycle.
Okay.
If Trump isn't elected, I think that transition happens a lot faster, and I probably give us less than a year. So, and that's just my analysis of connecting some dots, looking historically, when did those transitions happen and how did they happen? And, you know, you can look back in the 80s and the savings and loan crisis and the ensuing RTD, or RTC, RTD is our Denver Metro, Transit Authority, the RTC days and the turmoil started earlier and the resulting reactions didn't happen for a few years later.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I think. I think we've got less than a year if Trump is not reelected. I think we've got about 4 years if he is.
Is your expectation he will get reelected, out of curiosity?
Based on what we see right now, at the time that we're recording this, I think so, because I think that if the coronavirus didn't exist, and I'm not going to get into any conspiracy theories, but if it didn't exist, if you look at the margin debt inside the stock market, if you look at debt, okay, bankers make markets and bankers crash markets. What I mean by that is liquidity and debt, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you look at the stock market, the margin debt in the stock market, meaning how much money has been borrowed to prop up the price of the stock market.
Yeah.
It's significantly greater than in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And look at every market out there, from the housing market to the student loan debt market to the car market to the oil markets to everything. It's all propped up with debt. I think that it's very likely that the administration knew this was coming regardless of. And I think that it happens to be convenient that there's something to blame, right? Yeah. That the correction is as a result of coronavirus, the And I'm not discounting coronavirus. It's a real thing, right? But what I'm saying is that it's convenient that we can blame that, and then we can do certain things to stabilize, recover, save millions and millions of lives, and then sweep the election in November because of all of the things we did right.
Come out looking like roses, the administration.
That's right.
I get it. Okay. Well, you talked. Why don't we start to kind of wind down the show here? There's been a lot to unpack here, Rob. You talked about, you know, bankers make markets and essentially just based on the liquidity. And I heard you talk last week, and maybe what we'll do is we'll include a link to that Facebook Live that you did last week in the show notes page
because it's
really informative. And it goes a little bit deeper on the front end, you know, and that's why I kind of wanted to just scratch the surface there and get more into practical advice, depending on, you know, people listening and where they're at in their business right now. I want you to talk a little bit about being the banker. You know, you talked on that Facebook Live about buying in price stable markets, and then the way that you exit a price stable market is on owner financing, right? Yep. Seasoning it for a period of 3 to 6 months and then selling that off to like the Wall Street guys. Go a little bit deeper. Talk a little bit about that. So obviously, you know, we're recording this in late March 2020. You know, where should people be focusing their efforts? And let's say there are people that are operating and doing deals in a boom bust market, you know, like I am here in Miami, in South Florida.
Yep.
Why don't we kind of start to talk to those people that are in some of those boom bust markets, what the price stable markets where they need to be looking into, and how you foresee things moving forward and how they kind of get into price stable markets and then exit once the crash happens, depending on the election.
Sure. Yeah, sure. So if you're in a boom bust market, I would be wholesaling today, and that's probably all I would do. There's enough investors out there that are just putting the blinders on and just continuing to go business as normal. Mm-hmm. And so I would probably not be buying and holding or fixing and flipping in a boom bust market in this market situation. The other piece of that is if I'm in a boom bust market and I don't want to just wholesale, I would continue to wholesale locally. I would start to look at other markets. I would start to look at price stable markets and go virtual, right? Get out of your backyard. It's not scary, right? A house is a house is a house, right? A front door in Atlanta is the same as a front door in Minneapolis, the same as a front door in Miami, right? It's a front door and it opens into a living room and there's a kitchen and like, it's not that scary. And when you put some framework then to neighborhood grades and figuring that out, you can figure out any market in about 2 to 3 hours. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I would be, if I'm in a boom bust, I'm going to wholesale locally. I'm going to start looking at opportunities in price stable markets. If I'm already in a price stable market, I'm going to adjust my prices and I'm going to buy cheaper than what I've been buying. Mm-hmm. In all cases, I'm going to get really clear on my buy box and I'm going to only buy what fits my buy box.
Okay.
And I'm not going to deviate from it. And so if I'm in a price stable market, I'm going to continue to buy. I'm probably going to buy cheaper than I have been. And I'm going to be more conservative about what I buy and how I buy.
Are you, and just for clarification's sake, you're talking buy to hold and or wholesale, either or are you talking strictly buy and hold in these price stable markets?
Yeah. So host in a price stable market, I'm going to wholesale anything that doesn't fit my buy box.
Got it.
If it fits my buy box, I want to buy it. If it doesn't fit my buy box, I'm going to wholesale it. Right. And so I'm going to get really clear around that. The other thing that I would be that if it's me, I would be doing this. I would only be buying for Section 8 tenants.
I'm so glad you went there. That was a big when I've been in this business since 2005. And it's funny because a year and a half ago, Rob, I was banging my head trying to acquire cash flow producing assets here in Miami. And I couldn't find a house in the hood for less than like 130, 140 grand in the hood, right? And
right.
So I looked at Cleveland. So I started buying some rentals in Cleveland. And the more people I would talk to that had portfolios would say, hey, you want to be buying in B areas, you know, the C minus D areas. Returns look great on paper, but in reality, it's kind of a pain, right?
Yep.
I heard you talk and have a little bit of a different perspective.
Yep.
So I'm glad you went there, because for me, I was like, it just got me thinking a little bit different. Talk about why you prefer to go into the Section 8 versus like the B areas.
Yeah. It comes back to my historical, like I always try to project forward based on what have I learned from history, right? And so in 2007 and 8, I was buying, fixing, and flipping. And everybody that I was selling to, the only people that had money in the market was, or the majority of the money was FHA first-time home buyers. It was federally backed loans. Mm-hmm. And so I was buying, fixing, and flipping hundreds of houses to FHA first-time home buyers that were getting their money from the government. So as we went through that cycle and we started to move into the next cycle, and I started to write the book and I started to develop my theories and the things that I wanted to put into play going forward, I asked myself all of these questions. Where did the money come from in the crash? What sustained the crash? What allowed me to capitalize as a real estate investor and still take advantage of things in the crash? And I looked at all things. You know, I looked at neighborhoods, and I looked at tenant and buyer, you know, profiles, and I looked at financing options, and I looked at all these things, and I realized from a financing standpoint, the money came from the government. And then I said, what was my $30 million mistake? It was that I didn't buy and hold everything I could get my hands on at that time. So as I projected then forward to where we are today, I look at it and I say, you know what? And I started doing this in 2015. I started buying in C, C minus, and D plus neighborhoods. And everybody, Alex told me that I was crazy, that I should be buying in nicer neighborhoods. I'm giving up appreciation. And the reason I did it is because I realized that when markets crash, the thing that crashes markets on a housing level is at the household level, people can't afford their stuff. Mm-hmm. And so in 2007, people couldn't afford conventional mortgages. They could afford an FHA-backed mortgage with 3% down. In the market crash going forward, they can't afford their rent. And so if my income is going to come from them paying rent, they got to have a job that pays them, that pays the rent so that I have an income. How do I reduce my risk? Well, I go get the government to pay their rent, and my rent check shows up on time every time, except when the government shuts down a year ago, right? I had to wait 17 days to get my rent check, but it showed up. And so I think about the tenant triangle, and I see the top is, you know, those tenants that are living paycheck to paycheck. They got the nice Beamer out front. They got the nice, you know, they're living in the nice B class neighborhood, but they're paycheck to paycheck. They lose their job and they can't make rent. Then you've got the tenant layer that below that, they can go a couple weeks. And then you got the tenant layer that can go a couple months if they lose their job. But at a household level, if they lose their job, there's only a certain amount of time until they can't make the rent anymore. At the very bottom is the most stable, and that's the government. Now, if the government doesn't make the rent payment, which it's a social program for the lowest income in America, the likelihood of them abolishing that program is pretty low. Yeah. So I think from a risk perspective there, I'm pretty safe. I'm pretty sure that the feds aren't going to stop paying rent for that segment of income level. Yeah. And so I get my rent check. Did I give up on some appreciation? Maybe, but you can't eat equity. I can eat cash flow.
That's right. Rob, out of curiosity, and this is, it's relevant to the conversation, but we don't need to go too deep into this. Would you say, generally speaking, in your experience, that having those types of assets, maybe it's a little bit more involved than having, and I'm just kind of playing devil's advocate, would you say it's a little bit more involved from an active perspective, whether you're self-managing or even if you have a property management company, or has that just not been your experience if you qualify the right tenants?
Yeah, it has not really been my experience. I mean, it's called investing in real estate, right? There's always risk. There are always problems. There's always something that goes on, right? I manage the manager. And, you know, I let the management company handle this stuff, but I manage the manager. Like, I'll give you an example. And this doesn't happen as much in a B-class neighborhood. It probably happens more in a C-minus class neighborhood. I get an email from my property manager that says my tenant on XYZ Street is complaining because there's ants all over the counter. And so the property management company wants to know if you know, I will authorize the $50 to have their handyman go out there and assess the situation and clean it up and put out traps. And they don't expect that to cost more than $100 to resolve everything. Uh-huh. My reply back was, tell the tenant to clean their counters and don't leave food on the counters and wash their dishes and the ants will go away. So that sounds mean.
No, it doesn't.
But I'm not going to spend $100 out of my cash flow because you can't clean your counters.
Right.
And I get that the property management company makes money running maintenance calls. So I get all of the scenarios. And so my reply back to them was exactly that. Tell the tenants to clean their counters. I'm not paying for that. Yeah. And oh, by the way, Ace Hardware ant traps are $5 a dozen or whatever it is, right? Guess what happened? I saved the $100 and I never heard about ants again.
Right. Yep.
So you just manage the manager.
Sure. Beautiful, brother. Beautiful. Well, hey, man, we'll get you out of here on this. You acquired FreedomSoft. What was it now? 4 or 5 years ago?
5 years ago.
5 years ago. I've seen the amount of work that you and your team have put into it. It almost looks like a completely different software today than it was. And that's to your credit. Not that it wasn't a good software back then, but it was just a different, it's got a lot more bells and whistles. And I think you're an active operator and you've been in this business a long, long time and you've just done a lot of improvements to the software. And this doesn't have to be a commercial for FreedomSoft or anything, even though in 100% transparency, I've been a FreedomSoft user. I do have an affiliate link if you guys want to check it out. Highly recommend it, flipempire.com/FreedomSoft. But just what are some of the things that you and your team have done to FreedomSoft that real estate investors can take advantage of, especially, you know, during these times?
Yeah, well, so I'll go as far as saying that when I bought FreedomSoft, I didn't think it was a very good product. I didn't buy it because the product was great 5 years ago. I bought it because the business was great. The user community was great. The brand was great. And the bones were great. And the team was great. Mm-hmm. And so I bought the business because I knew that I had a vision for where it could go. And it had enough greatness under the hood that I knew that if I took the cash flow and just reinvested into the product itself, mm-hmm. we could get the product where the product is today. And so some of the things that we've done that are huge, the first thing that we tackled was lead management. And in real estate, you know, I always tell people the margin's in your mouth and the fortune's in the follow-up. And people ask me all the time, you know, Rob, I'm not making money as a real estate investor. What should I be doing? And I ask him this one simple question. How many offers did you make last week? Right? If you're not making offers, you're not making money. And so we first tackled lead management because I'm a huge, huge, huge believer that you organize before you automate. Mm. And so we built natural organization into the structure of FreedomSoft. Then what we did is we said, okay, where do people lose their leads? Okay, we've got a great lead management system, but where does their lead management break down? And it was around the phone system. And because there were third-party phone systems everywhere that people either had to figure out how to integrate with other software, or they just had them living in separate places. They had the lead and the address and the name over here with some notes, and they had all of the conversations over here. So we integrated that all together seamlessly. The next thing we said is, okay, now that we've got the organization, we've tackled this missing gap, right, of the phone, of the conversations and the communication. What next? Well, it became the automation. And so we then built our workflow and our automation sequences around the organization of the lead campaigns.
Okay.
And so one of the things, Alex, that we do a lot of times in our demos, that people are making a switch from another software into FreedomSoft, we'll look at their software and we'll say, okay, look at this. What can you tell me about your lead campaigns right now? And they're like, yeah, I don't really know. Then we'll take him over and we'll show him one of the lead campaigns in my system. And I'll say, what can you tell me about this lead campaign? What can you tell me about Mark's lead campaign? And they'll be like, well, he's got this many in follow-up, this many warm, this many cold, this many active leads, this many offers made. Like I said, so you know more about Mark's campaign than you know about your own campaign right now. Because we built a visual leads dashboard around being able to see the pipeline. And we put all of those things in a way that just kind of works. So then we said, okay, now that we have all this, how are we going to help people get more leads? Yeah. And so we built Lead Finder. And so inside of FreedomSoft, as you well know, you can tap into 108 million plus property records nationwide and build your own marketing list and apply vacant flags and search by property types and geographies and zip codes and you name it, buyers and sellers and private lenders and the whole nine yards. And so we eliminated hundreds of dollars of third-party software costs, and we made the integration all in one seamless thing. And so that's my 3.5 minute, 5 year trajectory.
Love it, man.
There's a lot more inside of there, but that's some highlights.
I get it. Well, guys, check it out. FlipEmpire.com/FreedomSoft. We'll include a link in the show notes. Rob, I appreciate you, man. I always end these shows with, you know, kind of, hey, rewind the clock 20 years. What's the one piece of advice you'd wish you'd share that you knew back then? I'm going to kind of tweak that a little bit. You know, you've been in this game 2 decades now, you know, yep. You've seen a lot, you've done a lot, you've accomplished a lot, you've worked with a lot of investors. What is that one piece of advice? Not that you wish you knew back then, but that you're giving people now.
Cash flow. Pure and simple. Cash flow. So I got into the business, I built a little cash flow. You know, in my first 18 months, I bought like 40 houses, but I wasn't a good landlord. I was trying to self-manage it. I wasn't good at it. And so I started to sell some of that off. I got down to a core. Then I sold off in 2006, as we talked about. And so I got kind of out of the cash flow game and I started to fix and flip and wholesale. And that's transactional, man. You've got to get, like, if you're going to do the work once that gets you paid forever. I call it the trap, right? Transactional, residual, active, and passive, TRAP. Yeah. And you want residual passive income. Residual is the frequency that you get paid. Mm-hmm. Passive is the effort it takes to get paid. So you want that RP income instead of the transactional active income. So man, cash flow.
I love it. And that's a perfect way to end this because we had you back on episode 92 where we talked about creative deal structuring. You talked about trap. So guys, check that out. FlipEmpire.com/episode92. And Rob goes a lot deeper into that. Brother, I really appreciate you, man. Thank you. Like I told you before the show, I've always admired you. I've learned a lot from you throughout the years and you know, appreciate your friendship and you being a voice of reason out there and just always providing quality content and training. So
thanks, man.
Just want to acknowledge you for that.
Appreciate it. Well, likewise, Alex, appreciate you.
Appreciate you guys. And thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this. I might even make this available before it goes live on social media, because I think this is information people need sooner rather than later. But just, you know, speed of implementation, guys. Take action on one thing. I would highly suggest that be what Rob just ended with, cash flow. Trust me, take it from someone who's been on the active side for a long time. And Rob, you and I have had plenty of conversations about that. Generate cash flow sooner rather than later, because that's what ultimately gives you the freedom, right? So I appreciate you and I look forward to connecting with you on the next one. Have an awesome one, guys.
That's all for this episode of the Flip Empire Show. But we have you covered with even more expertise and resources on our website. Text EMPIRE to 67076 or head over to FlipEmpire.com to join the newsletter and gain free instant access to our video module training course called 5 Ways to Scale Your Real Estate Wholesaling Business to 6 Figures in 6 Months or Less. For more interviews, strategies, and insights for the smart real estate investor, we'll catch you next time here on the Flip Empire Show.